The Athletic.
If you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, now's the time with our best offer ever. Sign up today and you'll pay just £1 a month for the next 6 months, giving you unrivaled insight and analysis of everything Euro 2020 and taking you well into the new Premier League season too. The Athletic is the only place you can read pieces by award-winning writers like Michael Cox, Rafa Honigstein, Amy Lawrence and Daniel Taylor. And when you subscribe, you'll also get ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts from across its audio network. Head to theathletic.com/totally and become a subscriber today for £6 until the end of the year. That's theathletic.com/totally.
Good afternoon, passengers. This is a pre-boarding announcement for flight 89. Please have your boarding pass and identification ready.
Baku, Sevilla,
Amsterdam,
Glasgow,
München,
St. Petersburg,
Bucharest,
Budapest,
Copenhagen,
Roma, London.
Unbelievable! It's Destination Knowledge on this Totally Football show at the Euros as we fire up part two of our preview. Checking in on France, they're the creme de la creme, and now they've added Karim. Netherlands, Frank de Boer is the Orangey manager. We ask a local, aren't you worried? Germany, Spain, North Macedonia, Ukraine and more, with all the big stories from 12 more contenders coming up in this Totally Football show at the Euros in association with Paddy Power. Hello there, listener. Not long now, eh? And we've got another preview show for you. And providing today's Euro samples, we have from France, Julien Laurence.
Bonjour.
A little bit later, we'll be hearing from Raphael Honigstein of Germany. Also, Alvaro Romeo on Spain, Mikael Jongsma on the Netherlands. And here with us now, Duncan Alexander from the realm of digital post-humanity, who didn't qualify for this tournament, but I know you've got a big interest in it anyway, Duncan.
Bonjour, aussi. Yeah, we just missed out at the end due to a hologram glitch. But, you know, we'll be back. We'll be back.
Right. Woo! Let me hear you say woo, Julien.
Woohoo! I'm pumped. I mean, my team will win it, so we know it already. So, you know.
Yeah. Oh. Well, that's a bold call.
That's it, isn't it? Is the show done?
Yeah.
Oh, you want me to stay? You still want me to stay? Okay.
The Euros as an entity, where do you stay? Are you with those people who actually prefer it to the World Cup? Duncan, no?
No, the World Cup's got a level of cosmopolitanism and just different, you know, like it brings the globe together. I know that the Euros is watched all over the world, but, you know, like playing a team from Central America or Asia, there's a lot more interest, I think. I find the Euros is sort of a tournament of great games rather than great tournaments. Everyone can pick out four or five classic matches that have been the Euros, but it's hard to really, you know, pinpoint a single tournament that stands out that, you know, in a way that, say, France 98 did or Mexico 1970 or something.
Interesting. Well, maybe Greece's campaign in 2004 in Portugal, but that's perhaps more to do with Greece. This tournament's certainly going to stand out, though, because of the fact that it's all over the continent. It is such a different format. And we were mentioning in our first preview show how much that might play into teams' chances. Sides like Hungary, who are going to be playing in front of capacity crowds for two of their home games, not the most fancied of sides, but there could be a bit of a wild card factor in there.
Yes, definitely. I mean, look at England. I think this is, for me, this is a tournament in England. England will be on home soil pretty much the whole way if they go fast. That's a huge advantage, even if it's not full stadium for England, for example, and other countries. I think it's a big help. It's a bit like those Champions League games that we had where you had to play the home tie on neutral ground, for example, but the second leg was on the home stadium of that team that was supposed to have the second leg. I think it's a bit like that, and I think it's a big advantage to have, and also less travelling for teams who play in their country, which I think counts too. So it's good. It's good for you if you have some home games.
France don't have that advantage, of course, Jules. Should we start off today's second half of previews with their group? Group F, they call it, the group of death. It features European Championship holders Portugal, World Cup winners France, Hungary, who were good several decades ago, and Germany, who, well, same really. to kick us off, one of our Euro memories.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Do you know what that was, Jules?
Of course, France-Portugal in Marseille at the Vélodrome semi-final of the 1984 Euros. Jean Tigana, the N'Golo Kanté of the 80s, the never-tired Jean Tigana, the father of N'Golo Kanté, pretty much, with an amazing run, and then the cross, and then Platini with the finish, and a 3-2 win.
In the 119th minute against Portugal, taking France through to what was then their first major final, of course, since then. You've won everything. You arrive at this tournament as world champions.
Didn't win the tournoi, did they?
Fair. Almost everything.
That's why we never played it again. You know, we never organised it again because we didn't win it.
Right. But you arrive as world champions and you've gone and added Karim Benzema. Woo!
Woo indeed, James. I never thought really we would see Karim Benzema again with this shirt, with the national team. And yet, 5.5 years later, he came back. I think he shows the intelligence of Deschamps in a way, but also his pragmatism, because Deschamps realized that he would have more chances of winning this competition with Benzema in the team and in the squad than without, which maybe wasn't the case in 2018, for example, where I think the unity, the harmony in the squad, and also the talent at disposal was maybe enough for the way they wanted to play. Maybe for this competition, it was a bit different. But if you add a Karim Benzema, even at 33, maybe in the best form of his life, to an already World Cup winning squad, as you said, because let's not forget, and let's remind everyone that we won the World Cup in 2018. It's a better team. It's a much mature team, a better team, and I think it's a better squad than the one we had 3 years ago.
Are you going to have a front three of Griezmann, Mbappe and Benzema?
That's the plan, my friend. That is the plan. I mean, you can forfeit. And whoever wants to forfeit, they can forfeit before playing us.
Then behind them, you've got what? Kante and Pogba?
Yeah, and then Tolisso, Rabiot, depending on how you want to play. Coman, Dembele, Lemar.
Wow.
And then the back four that was very solid at the World Cup and won the World Cup in many respects.
I mean, I do remember a lot of this chat heading into World Cup 2002. You know, on paper, the French team, you know, reigning world and European champions were the greatest team ever seen. And it didn't work out at that time. But yeah, I mean, hats off. That is a reasonable squad.
Is the arrival of Benzema in place of the very popular Olivier Giroud, is there a potential disruption there, Jules? Somebody who hasn't been called in for 6 years because of personality issues, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, because of a attempt of blackmailing a teammate, which is, I guess, maybe
that
a
sounds
different
better.
Personalities
You're right.
issues. Yeah, but the fact that Giroud is in the squad, so had Giroud been dropped and Benzema literally taking his place in the squad, maybe it would have been, the feelings would have been different. The fact is that Deschamps asked some of the players what they thought of Benzema coming back before he called him back, and the response was really positive. I think the younger generation, the Mbappe grew up watching Karim Benzema play for Real Madrid. Same with Kingsley Coman, for example, and others. And then the older generation, the likes of Lloris, even Griezmann, played with Benzema with the national team, Pogba as well. So there's really a feeling of the ones who were there before know him so well. He was part of the team before, the leader of that team. He's back. Okay, that's fine. There's nothing special. The younger ones, they see him as like, wow, this is Karim Benzema, the Karim Benzema. We've never played with him, only ever watched him on television. Sometimes for some of them played against him. And I think for them, it's a big bonus in terms of let's follow the guide, basically. And for Giroud, They kissed and made up when they played against each other with Real Madrid and Chelsea this season. They had a chat.
Right.
Giroud knows that if France win this Euros, even if he doesn't play much, Karim Benzema could be a big reason why. So for him, if that makes France better and giving him more chances to win it, he goes with it. And like he said last week, they can go and celebrate doing a go-kart race.
Okay, nice. Benzema, of course, missing a penalty in France's recent friendly against Wales. I was groping there, really, Jules, for some potential thing that might go wrong, some complication, something that might be a concern to French supporters. Is there something else, something more realistic you think that could hamper Deschamps' side in this?
There's always. I mean, potential issues. I mean, don't laugh about it. But we are very confident going into this tournament. So much that I think I will have to leave the country for a few weeks if we don't win it, because I've opened my mouth so much and so loudly that I suspect the return would be quite heavy on me. But maybe too much. Maybe there's too much confidence. Maybe the balance of the team when you play with Griezmann and Benzema and Mbappe and Pogba in behind won't be good enough when you play against the big teams later on the competition, maybe, or even as soon as Germany on Tuesday. I don't know. Maybe defensively, the fullbacks who were maybe potentially the weakness, certainly at right back with Pavard, maybe that could be something that other team can exploit. There's always potential problems there, but right now it looks like this team has pretty much everybody fit, more or less. They're certainly not far from full fitness. Everybody's on good form. Okay, penalties is an issue because they've missed 5 out of the last 8. Benzema has missed 3 in a row now, if you count the ones he missed before being dropped by Deschamps. Griezmann the same, Mbappe the same as well. So maybe penalties is a bit of a worry, but apart from that, it looks pretty good.
I mean, the only other thing, I'm scraping the barrel a little bit, but if you do try and think of bad games in N'Golo Kante's hat, they tend to be more for France than in club football. It's kind of the reverse Jordan Pickford in that sense, isn't he? In that he reserves his best form often for club football. But yeah, I mean, it is looking pretty frightening. But also, I think, you know, it's the group of death, but it's not really, is it? Because with this third place, you know, the four best third place teams, it's like a kind of group of death that you'd get in Game of Thrones, where someone dies and then, oh look, magically they've come back to life and they're not really dead. So I think, yeah, that first game is pivotal, because say Germany did pull off a surprise win and Portugal beat Hungary in their first game, then it does put France on the back foot. But even in that scenario, you can't see them not picking up, you know, at least 3 points, and that should be enough anyway to get through.
Jules,
I don't completely agree with what Duncan said, in the sense that Kante had some really good games with France as well. Just look at the World Cup, for example, the semi-final against Belgium. However, if he can play at the level that we've seen him play the last 2 months with Chelsea, with France during these Euros, I think he would be incredible. I think he would be on his way to winning the Ballon d'Or, especially if France go really far in this tournament. And I think he would deserve it, because he's been incredible in 2021.
Certainly has. What a midfield lineup the French have. You know what, though? There is an argument that it's not the strongest midfield even in this group, let alone the competition, because the holders, Portugal, have got some players themselves. How about that? Bernardo Silva, Jota, João Felix, and Bruno Fernandes. Wow. Portugal, they're the holders of this, the reigning Nations League holders as well. Could they do it again, Duncan?
It's strange with Portugal, because obviously 5 years ago they won the tournament, but they weren't that great. It felt like the kind of last hit out from a team and a generation that had served them well, but didn't have much left yet. So they come into this tournament as holders, but, you know, I would say with a stronger squad. They only won one game in 90 minutes last time round. They didn't even win a group game, but benefited from our favourite mechanism to get the four best third place teams through. So yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people have kind of overlooked them. Not even look them, but kind of are underestimating how good they are now.
And it's a better squad, you reckon, this time than last time?
Yeah, I would say so. They've got more options. Mm. They've got André Silva. He is, you know, essentially the sort of striker that Portugal haven't had for a long time. Now, he's not going to get in the team ahead of Ronaldo. No one would do that, for obvious reasons. But, you know, Ronaldo is now 36. Can he play this amount of games in such a short period of time? He didn't even make it to the end of the last tournament. So, you know, it's that strength and depth that I don't think they've had necessarily in previous tournaments. Yeah, and I think they won't be perturbed either by this group. I mean, the one thing you can say is they very rarely win their opening game. I don't think they've ever won their opening match at Euros, yet they've always got through the group. So they're kind of tournament experts, if you like. They know how to kind of pace themselves over 6 or 7 games and get the job done, brackets except against Greece in 2004, but generally they know what they're doing. So yeah, I mean, I think You could easily see France and Germany drawing that game, and Portugal kind of taking advantage and, you know, taking control of that group early on. And they feel like the sort of team that, if that happens, that, you know, the confidence they have will kind of carry them through. So,
all right. How many players they've got? Cristiano Ronaldo mentioned. Ooh, the Football Writers Player of the Year, Ruben Dias, of course, keeping things tight for them at the back. And Pepe. Don't forget Pepe. He's now 38, but we saw in the Champions League this year, still got it. Jules.
The only thing is Fernando Santos is a very defensive-minded coach. That's how they won in 2016. That's what they do. The problem is that this time, they should have evolved a little bit more towards, okay, how can we use all this incredible attacking potential that we have to find the best way of playing as many as we can of those incredible talents going forward and make our game evolve? And yet they're still playing like they did 5 years ago. And I do think that the problem is, and we saw it against Spain in that friendly where they drew 0-0, just did nothing. And a bit in the last few games as well, where they don't make enough of the potential that they have going forward, because essentially they are a defensive-minded team and they still play that way. And I just don't think it would be enough in this tournament.
That is kind of often how you do win tournaments, though. You know, Spain won the World Cup scoring 8 goals in the whole thing. So I think if there's one tournament you can win by not kind of making the most of your attacking talents, is possibly a World Cup or a Euros. But yeah, I mean, I know what you mean. And France, we all love France, don't we? They'll be the most exciting team in the group.
Portugal's schedule is going to be a tough one. Unlike some nations, they won't have the benefit of home crowds. They go Budapest, then Munich, then back to Budapest, the opening game there against a Hungary team whose home support is pretty vocal. I don't know if you recall the scenes before they had that playoff. They needed a playoff to get to the Euros, and it came against Iceland, and those crowds beforehand doing the Icelandic claps in the streets. And then extraordinary, the finish of that game. Iceland were a goal up with 88 minutes played, and 4 minutes later, it was Hungary that was going through as 2-1 winners.
Goal! Goal!
Wow. All right, Hungary. Szoboszlai, who scored the winner there, won't be at this Euros because unfortunately he's injured, which is a big shame because what a player he is. Crowds will be. What do you make of Hungary's chances, Jules?
I think they've got no pressure. They would play in front of their home fans. They don't often qualify for those big tournaments. And certainly the fact that Szoboszlai is not there is a huge miss, because he's more than their best player, really. But without him, they would be solid. That's why they will go there and be, you know, Gulashi in goal and people like that, Willy Orban at the back. And I think that's the way you can expect them to play. And that's why I think that a team like Portugal against a team that doesn't give you much, like Hungary, will have to find a way of beating them.
61,000, 100% capacity, basically, at the Puskás Arena for their two home games there. So that's going to be potentially quite a big factor in their favour,
yeah,
Duncan.
I mean, I think the Puskás Stadium's in with a shot of winning the Ballon d'Or this year, because you think how well it set up the Champions League in the last stages. And it is a bit strange, the whole crowd thing, in the sense that this tournament was always going to be unusual with some teams having home advantage and some not. But then, you know, some teams are going to have more home advantage than others. And I think we have found out this season, just finished, that there is such a thing as, you know, home advantage when you have supporters. So yeah, there is a real curveball, Hungary having, you know, 100% capacity. And I think, yeah, it sets up that opening game of Portugal really, really nicely, because if they can pull something off there. And don't forget, they drew 3-3 with Portugal in the last Euros, one of the games of the tournament, actually.
They actually finished top of that group.
Yeah. And historically, they've always been good at kind of hanging in there. I mean, I think 9 of their 11 goals in European Championship history have come in the second half or extra time. So they, you know, they don't kind of give up. They, it's... I've just convinced myself that this is the group of death again now. So, yeah.
You know what? That, if France are dangerous and Portugal are clearly dangerous, and if Hungary are dangerous too, this could mean real problems for Germany. To hear a little bit more about them, let's speak now to a man who's a long way from home, and that's Raphael Honigstein. Where are you, Raph?
I'm in Portugal, James. I'm spending a bit of time here before I can get into Germany without having to quarantine, so a bit of a pit stop.
I see. Well, I hope you're taking the time to enjoy yourself there, because I don't know how much enjoyment you're going to get out of this tournament with Germany, three times European champions. But how, what shape are they in as they arrive at this Yogi Love's final tournament?
It's difficult to say. They had a fairly decent result against Latvia, but as the name suggests, difficult to read too much into it. 7-1 win, everyone's very happy. But of course, the last 3 years since the disaster at Russia have not really been marked by consistency, neither in terms of results nor performances. So I think we're still all wondering a little bit what kind of Germany will turn up. And I think that includes one or two of the German players themselves. Löw has experimented with lots of different formations, lots of different personnel choices. His latest ploy has been to draft Joshua Kimmich back into a right wing-back role to make space for Kroos and Gundogan in the centre. But I think there is a suspicion that against France, those two might not be enough, and we might well see a slightly more defensive formation with a third midfielder and Kimmich coming back in.
Right. Those last 3 years, as you mentioned, very tough for Germany fans. Bottom of the group in the World Cup in Russia. A 6-0 defeat to Spain in the Nations League. And then in the World Cup qualifying recently, losing at home to North Macedonia. Rafa, and for your first game in this new tournament, you've got the world champions France. How worried are you?
I'm pretty worried. I think Germany would do well to get a draw against France. A win would be, of course, fantastic, but I think it really is the worst possible opening game. You'd want to start with ease into the tournament. German teams tend to do well when they start well. When they don't, things can go awry very, very quickly. So, and that's why I think there is a lot of trepidation going into this game. I mean, even by German standards, and we, of course, have invented the concept of angst, I think it's particularly uneasy now this year, because I think Löw has lost a lot of goodwill. There used to be the presumption, certainly after the World Cup that he won in Brazil, that somehow German teams would come good, even before that. Tournaments by and large were successful with Germany going into the final or semi-final. I don't sense that same kind of confidence, certainly not outside the camp, even though everyone inside the camp says they had a wonderful couple of weeks in Austria preparing and the teams coming together. I'm just not 100% sure there is really is coming together.
Well, there is enough talent there in the squad for the team to come good. You've got veterans like Mats Hummels and Thomas Müller coming back in, Serge Gnabry, Rudiger, Kai Havertz, Timo Werner, whose form, we'll see how that's been affected by the season that he's had. It's a strong squad, Raf.
I think the quality is there individually, which makes it all the more disappointing and frustrating that they haven't been able to play well, nor have a consistent starting 11, or at least an idea of a starting 11 in the last 3 years. Löw, not all due to his own fault, because there were injuries and COVID and all sorts of things, had to make a lot of changes. But within all those changes, or amidst all those changes, Germany has sort of lost a little bit of, I don't want to say identity, but the idea of what they're supposed to be. There was a lot of 3-4-3 being played. A lot of it felt very perfunctory, you know, with strange midfield man-to-man marking inspired by Atalanta, but of course not nearly done well enough. There was a bit of counter-attacking football. There was a return to more possession-based football in the recent Euro qualifiers. It's been a sort of a mishmash, and nothing's really stuck. And I think the fact that he felt it necessary to come back to Hummels and Müller shows you just how half-baked this transition has been. If everything had gone much more convincingly, then there wouldn't have been that need to recall these guys, nor the need, or possible need, to put Kimmich back into a right back or right full back position, which again shows you that there are real problems in the side.
Mm. Well, Rafa, after the trauma of the experience in Russia, is there part of you that's thinking, well, maybe I won't go to Munich next week. Maybe I'll just stay in this bar overlooking the Atlantic in Portugal and sit this one out?
The thought has crossed my mind once or twice, especially after I watched a little bit of Germany play the previous game against Denmark, where they were once again pretty unconvincing, certainly in the second half. But no, I will go to Munich. I'm reliably informed that the four best third place teams get into the last 16 as well. That might be an avenue that Germany have to take. Even so, I don't think we're going to see Germany getting deep into this competition. I just think there are too many issues. I'd love to be surprised. I'd love to be wrong. But I just don't have the best of feelings about this.
Okay. Well, if you finish runner-up in the group, you could just be facing England, of course, because the runner-up of this group faces the winner of England's group at Wembley in the last 16. Wouldn't that be a thing? Rafa, for now, enjoy yourself there. And we look forward to catching up with you soon.
Thank you, James. Bye-bye.
Well, that was atmospheric. Duncan, who would you most like England to avoid?
Portugal, I think, in the last 16. I think that, as Jules was saying, you know, they're very obdurate. I think they would be the team England would find it hardest to break down. And, you know, the pressure would be on England playing at home, you know, assuming the potential scenarios, etc. So Portugal and then obviously France, I think, would be... I mean, I think France would beat England 8 times out of 10. But, again, I think France would probably give England a few more chances than Portugal would.
I see. All right, well, next up, let's move on to Tales of the Netherlands and others in Group C.
Euros are here, and you'd better make the most of them because they only come around every 4-5 years. So, if your bookie isn't making you feel special, then maybe it's time to find a new one. Yep, not so much carpe diem as carpa diem, yeah? If the grass is greener on the other side, come and play on it. If your bookie's not giving you the best rewards, switch and you'll get a completely free £5 bet builder on all England's group games. Paddy Power. Pre-match bet builder bets only min 2 plus legs online exclusive. Must have previously deposited to avail. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Buren. Van Basten. Goed. Oh, the goal! What a goal! What a schitterend doelpunt!
1988, listener. An MVB being MVP, winning Netherlands their only trophy ever. That was actually Dutch commentary. It sounds just like English, doesn't it? Anyway, these days, it's something if the Netherlands even qualify for a tournament. They missed out on the Euros in 2016 and the World Cup 2 years later as well. This time, though, they are there and in Group C, along with Austria, Ukraine and North Macedonia. All the games are going to be played from this group in Amsterdam and Bucharest. So, Netherlands at their first major tournament since 2014. For a laugh, they'll be facing it with one of the worst managers they've ever produced, Frank de Boer. Mikael Jongsma joins us now to discuss that and more. Mikael, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a long wait for the Netherlands. What's the mood like ahead of the tournament?
Well, yeah, it is a long wait because it's 7 years now since the Dutch male team. The women have done a lot better, I must say. But since the male team has come up for a big tournament. And last year, the mood was really quite exuberant. People were in good spirits. with a good head coach and a solid preparation. But this time it's a bit different. People are quite skeptical going into the Euros this time.
Is that because of the change in manager?
Yeah, the change of manager hasn't really helped. It's been a bit of a downgrade. Frank de Boer hasn't really been lucky with his last few roles in management. People were hoping that he could turn around. And I mean, it's still early days. It's only 11 games into his tenure. But it doesn't really inspire the same freshness that Ronald Koeman seemed to be able to do.
Frank de Boer becoming the first Netherlands manager to go without a win in any of his first four games, which will sound slightly familiar to Crystal Palace supporters, maybe Inter supporters as well. But he did pick up four wins in the next five. That 4-2 defeat to Turkey, I guess, has shaken confidence a bit, as has the absence of Virgil van Dijk. How does the rest of the squad stack up, do you think, in terms of your chances in this group, Michaela?
Well, it's a bit of a funny squad, this, because, I mean, when you look at the individual players, especially in the center positions, it's actually not that bad. I mean, when you consider, apart from the, near extraterrestrial strikers in the Bundesliga and Ligue 1, Memphis and Wout Weghorst are probably two of the best out there. When you look at the midfield, Frenkie de Jong has been really good for Barcelona last year. Wijnaldum is a confident midfielder. Ryan Gravenberg is one of the biggest talents in that position as well. And when you look at the centre-back positions, I mean, Matthijs de Ligt and Daley Blind formed a very, very good pairing at Ajax when they almost reached the finals of the Champions League a couple of seasons ago. Stefan de Vrij, who won the title with Inter, was the best defender in Serie A last season. So even the absence of Virgil van Dijk from a quality point of view should not have deterred the Dutch that much. But in terms of leadership, it's a bit of a different story. And when you look at the wing positions, the Dutch have taken quite a tumble compared to earlier years.
Plus, of course, there's Van der Beek, who will be really fresh and looking forward to finally playing and showing what he's capable of. Hey? Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, my...
Yeah, that has been, on a personal level, an absolute drama. But even his inclusion was a bit of a controversy because in the press conference when they announced the squad, Frank de Boer said that he was actually fifth on the list of players with the most minutes in this squad. And apparently he had looked at his notes a bit wrongly because that were the minutes of Davy Klaassen. So, in terms of inspiring confidence as a coach, that doesn't really help when the 4,000-plus minutes that he claimed actually turned out to be 1,400 minutes. And Van de Beek has not had a vintage season, it's fair to say that, especially for a player like him. Last season, the Euros would be probably a bit more convenient. But, it is a bit of a blow because he can fulfill the role that Wijnaldum fulfills for the Netherlands quite well. A player that has a really good vision of how to work space, how to leech onto opportunities created by his teammates. But in terms of people actually being that creative in this Netherlands squad, it's not a vintage Netherlands squad because we don't really see any player that has the creativity that you would kind of like to have a chance at the title.
All right, the kind of creativity you associate with this nation above all others. The good news is that it's not, on paper, the toughest of groups, along with Austria, North Macedonia and Ukraine. So there's time there maybe for De Boer to find his feet and win over a few of the doubters.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has been a bit quite interesting because over the last few weeks, he's been experimenting with a 5-3-2 formation. A bit akin to what Van Gaal did 7 years ago, because the Turkey game, as you said, it has really shaken confidence because people thought that it should be impossible to concede four against the Turks. I must say that Turkey is probably a bit of a black horse in terms of a team that can do well, I think, especially with Burak Yilmaz being in absolute top form. And even that performance wasn't as bad as it actually did seem. But the adjustment to a five defender backline seems to come in at a really strange time. And when you look at the team that the Netherlands have, they have some promising fullback options in the likes of Owen Wijndal, who I suspect will become an absolute star over the next few years, or at least someone that goes to a really big club. Denzel Dumfries on the right has done a good job for PSV as well, and it's expected to make a new step afterwards. But these are players that are quite good at the defensive bit of the game, quite good at getting low crosses in or delivering like pullbacks, that kind of game. And to have the kind of surprise element, the extra effect of that type of player coming up, you would expect that you would like to have like maybe a bit of an inside forward type on either flank. And for a player like Wout Weghorst, who's kind of used to play a bit wider or at least have some backup from the flanks, it's going to be interesting to see how he will fit in into that system. And it's very much banking on Memphis Depay being the player that he was for Lyon last season, I think.
Well, the opening game is against Ukraine, who might be your stiffest competition in this group. And that's at the Johan Cruyff Arena in Amsterdam. What kind of crowds are we going to get there, Mikael?
I think the current number is 16,000 people are allowed into the stadium. So that's quite a lot compared to what we're used to by now.
Mm.
It is probably the toughest opponent. Ukraine have done quite well in against big teams recently as well. Fang de Boer had a bit of a slip of the tongue this year, as I said, not the first one really, but where he said where he predicted that they would beat Ukraine 3-1. So Shevchenko has already shown himself not really impressed, saying, apparently Fang de Boer knows things that I don't know yet. But yeah, he has really made sure that they'll be very focused and very sharp coming into this game.
Brilliant. All right, thanks so much, Mikael, for joining us, and look forward to speaking to you soon.
No problem, and have a good tournament already.
Mikael Jongsma. Jules.
I mean, I'm not going to tell you what I think of De Boer. However, why in a tournament like this, and you allow 26 players for a reason, why, if you lose Donny van de Beek to injury, which is a blow for them, no problem, why don't you replace him? Don't tell me there's no other player that could come in that squad to make it 26. And in case you've got a problem or in case you need another midfielder, for whatever reason, just replace him. I find that completely crazy and stupid that Luis Enrique only calls 24 out of 26 when he's allowed 26, that De Boer can have 26, loses one, Bestey 25. I don't get it.
We'll ask Alvaro Romeo about Spain and their 24-man squad a little bit later on. But you know what? Mikael was just talking about Ukraine there, and we mentioned them in our first preview show as being, along with Turkey, one of the dark horses. Sasha Gurionov has been looking at Ukraine admiringly. It's quite a common thing for Russians, of course. Let's hear from him now with his breakdown on Sheva's squad. Sasha, tell us all about Andriy Shevchenko's Ukraine.
Hi, James. I think this is going to be great because for me, Ukraine has perhaps potentially the standout player of the tournament, certainly the player in the best form going into the tournament. As you're aware, I'm talking about Ruslan Malinovsky of Atalanta, Serie A's player of the month for May, Atalanta's player of the month for the last few months, I think. So this is a great footballing side, and he's at the heart of that. Effectively, I think, ensuring that they don't feel any pain from the loss of Papu Gomez. And this creativity, I think this is what he brings to this Ukraine side. And I think it's him and Alexander Zinchenko, who, of course, plays in midfield for Ukraine, and he's the captain. But again, it shows what an absolutely brilliant, intelligent, adaptable player that he is. He's doing this obviously a great job for Pep Guardiola at fullback, but he plays across the middle for Ukraine, and those two players I think will define the way this team plays. Of course, there needs to be a holding midfielder behind them, so that's probably going to be Taras Stepanenko, who's going to be like the yard dog cleaning up after them. And perhaps again, the question is with many of these sides, is what's going to happen up front. And they have Roman Yeremchuk, who's been scoring quite a few goals in Belgium for Ghent, not the top team, which is a good sign. And obviously remember that Malinovsky came to Italy from Genk in Belgium. So potentially, again, if this lad has a good tournament, he has got a great move ahead of him. So I think sort of this formation, 4-1-4-1, is probably what they're going to go for. Remember also that Shevchenko isn't on his own. Mauro Tassotti is one of his assistants. And I think the big question for the opening game against Holland, which I think everyone's focused on, is whether Ukraine should go with three centre-backs, and especially as Holland are likely to go with two up top, three versus two and stuff. But, you know, I'm thinking, why don't they just stick to the best formation? Because Holland under De Boer have been a bit of a mess. Why don't they just go for it and play their own football?
Why not indeed? 2016, Ukraine failed to score a single goal. They're now managed by Ukraine's all-time top scorer, Andriy Shevchenko. Are you surprised? I never figured him for particularly someone who was going to go into an incredible managerial career. Are you surprised how well he's done, Sasha?
Perhaps not, because there is a thing with guys coming out of Dynamo Kiev. A lot of them seems to be disproportionate. Like, maybe I'm thinking too far back into the Soviet days, and maybe some of them were looked after by being given coaching jobs, effectively, by Dynamo Kiev.
But the Lobanovsky angle.
This is what I'm going to go with, because they've learned from the best man. They had to have, I think, a particular type of mindset to play for Lobanovsky. And of course, Shevchenko played for Lobanovsky. So I think you have to understand football quite well and your functions. So perhaps, maybe they, without even realizing, they think about football in a particular way. Yeah, I mean, you look at Shevchenko, you think, well, great forwards, great managers. But maybe you can look at Mancini, for example. But yeah, he's done a good job. I think a lot of the job was also political, of course, and I think we'll get onto that as well. But I think as a figure, he hasn't been above criticism, but at the same time, I think he's this team, like, they're looking good. Maybe he's been lucky that Malinovsky is coming in and Zinchenko are just two such gems in his side, and that certainly helps. But I'm looking forward to see how this team does.
Okay, they're unbeaten in qualifying. For Euro 2020, brackets in 21, they've unveiled an interesting new shirt design.
So on Monday morning, we found out that the new Ukraine kit has a Ukraine map on the chest, and that map shows that Crimea is part of Ukraine. And for some in Russia, apparently that's caused a bit of a problem. I don't really see why. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that Russian ownership of Crimea, shall we say, isn't really recognized by most countries in the world. I think Ukraine itself has a view on this as well, and they consider Crimea to be part of Ukrainian territory. And to be honest, though, this went through some approvals at UEFA, who found nothing political about it. I mean, as far as Ukraine were concerned, they're just showing a map of their own country. I mean, for me, I think they are definitely making a point, but I think they're making a point about their territorial integrity, which right. I think is fair enough. Another additional feature of the shirt is that it has a small slogan in it, Glory to Ukraine, Glory to the Heroes, which has its roots back probably 100 years ago during, the aftermath of a Russian Revolution. The civil war that embroiled the Russian Empire and the brief Ukrainian independence of the time. It was also associated with nationalist Ukrainian guerrillas during the Second World War. And it came back to the fore in 2014 as all the crises enveloped. And I think it is now the official greeting of the Ukrainian armed forces. I think it became 2 or 3 years ago. So obviously the war in the East is a huge thing for Ukraine. And again, I think they're making a point here to remind everyone, I think, as well as like a patriotic thing as well. So I think it's quite a lot of messaging on that shirt. And I think in Ukraine's position, I think it's perfectly understandable.
Yeah, Russian fans are upset by that. Crimea River, I think that's the slogan they should have on the back of the shirt. There you go.
It's like France including Calais on their maps, isn't it? It's ours, really, but, we'll let them have it for a bit.
Jersey and Guernsey.
Jules, you were shall we say, unenthusiastic about doing any previewing of Ukraine. What's the point, you said? Have you changed your mind at all now?
Not at all. I think Turkey, dark horses every day. Ukraine,
yep.
I'm not so convinced. Malinovsky has best player of the tournament. Good luck with that. Although he had a good second half of the season at Atalanta, and they've got Zabani, who's maybe the best young centre-back in the competition. I give them that. I'm not sure how far they go.
They haven't scored with any of their last 67 shots at European Championship finals games, which for me, as a fan of goals, is it's not very good, is it? So.
Right. Well, also in this group, Austria and North Macedonia. Austria, who predominantly ply their trade in the Bundesliga. Their form is not great. They had that 2-2 draw with Scotland. They lost 4-0 against Denmark. North Macedonia, a fascinating team. They qualified by winning the lowest of the Nations League sections, beating out Liechtenstein, Gibraltar, Armenia, Kosovo and Georgia to get here. But they did beat Germany, as we mentioned with Rafa earlier, just in this March. This is their first ever major tournament, and thus a first ever major tournament for Goran Pandev.
And to put that into context, he's playing in his first tournament 20 years after his international debut. And so the equivalent for England would be playing Kevin Davis at the 2030 World Cup, which you can't rule out at this stage, but it seems unlikely.
Pandev, who's 38 at the end of July, is the man who, of course, scored the goal against Georgia in the Nations League that got them effectively here. Incredible figure, Goran Pandev, and still almost identical to how he was 20 years ago. Other notable names in the squad include Elif Elmas of Napoli and Ezgan Alioski of Leeds. All right, then. Who's not going to go through from this group?
I think Austria have a really good squad. They have really good players. I'm not sure about Franco Foda, the manager, who's...
Yeah, that's the... Yeah. Austria, they had the biggest underperformance on XG in qualification. They're less than the sum of their parts. But, they, as Jules said, they have good players. They're in a tournament, that can sometimes click and you can have a good tournament. So, yeah, I would possibly say Austria for second place in this one.
All right. Franco Foda, who you mentioned, was a West German international. He tells a funny story. When he made his debut for West Germany, away to Brazil in 1987, people in the crowd laughed and cheered when he came on. This was in Brazil. He wasn't sure why until he discovered in Bild newspaper that Franco Foda means free sexual intercourse, or near enough to make the crowd titter. Anyway, all right.
But he wasn't a good manager when he was at club level, with Sturm Graz and all of that. So he hasn't become a good manager, which is a shame because, as we've been saying, this is a very, very talented squad. You know, Alaba and Sabitzer and Kalajic, the new the Stuttgart striker, they did really well in the Bundesliga, who's like 10 foot tall. They've got talent there. I'm just surprised that they're not really actually playing that well.
Who's not going through, Jules?
North Macedonia. As much as I would love them to be the story, they won't be. And I think Austria could finish second ahead of Ukraine. I mean, Franck de Boer is a clown anyway, as I said before. I'm not sure about the Netherlands in this competition.
All right, let's move on. Let's make like footballers in Ayia Napa and finish off with some Group E action.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, host of The England Show, brought to you daily throughout Euro 2020. I'll be joined by writers from The Athletic and special guests to bring you unrivaled coverage dedicated to the England team this summer. So for expert insight into Southgate's squad and post-game reaction to all the games, search for The England Show wherever you get your podcasts or via The Athletic app.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Ingerson, Brolin, Dalin, Brolin, brilliant, brilliant goal. And a really finely worked goal that Sweden have thoroughly deserved.
Woof, Euro memories again. That's Thomas Brolin. Do you hear that, Duncan? Scoring the winner for Sweden against England in the 1992 UEFA European Championship. Graham Taylor, of course, ashen-faced on the sidelines. Do you remember the headlines the next day? Swedes 2, Turnips 1, with a picture of poor Graham as a kind of root crop.
Yeah, a lot, because the turnip motif continued during qualification for USA 94, and I think a lot of people who've seen that are a bit, you know, confused as to why the press chose a turnip. But yeah, that was the origin story.
It's the Swedes.
Obviously, that was a haunting game in English football history, that one. So
certainly is. Anyway, Sweden, who were World Cup quarterfinalists 3 years ago, are back again. They're in Group E, along with Poland, Slovakia and Spain. All the games are going to be played in Seville and St. Petersburg, which doesn't help the Swedes very much. They don't have Zlatan, who'd come out of international retirement for the tournament, only to be then ruled out with a knee injury. Zlatan not the only big name to pull out, because Juve's youngster Dejan Kulusevski's just tested positive, Jules.
Yeah, that's right, James. Just today, probably the batch of tests this morning. So I don't know if that means he's out completely or if he just have to self-isolate and then do another test in a week or something. And then if that's negative, coming back into the squad, a squad that will have now surely, like the Spanish one, have to go itself all in self-isolation, and it's another mess, basically.
Mm. They do have some other interesting youngsters capable of scoring the goals. Alexander Isak of Real Sociedad, who notched up 17 goals in La Liga this season, also 21. And there's Henrik Larsson's son, Jordan, who's had a pretty good season for Spartak Moscow.
Yeah, that's right. Especially the second half of the year, James. He was fantastic, both in terms of assist and goal scores. And with Isak, we knew how talented he was. The potential was always there, even when he moved to Dortmund really young. But it's just the maturity that he's gained at Real Sociedad with Imanol, the good season that they've had, and the sort of the mindset that he has now in the box. It would have been great to see him with Zlatan. Hopefully we can see him with Kulusevski up front or with Jordan Larsson. They also have Marcus Berg in the old guard. They've got a right blend in Sweden between the youth and the more experienced players. So it'd be very interesting to see. I think they can cause problems even without Kulusevski to a lot of teams.
Mm. Well, they certainly surprised a lot of people at their last big tournament in 2018. They're not the favourites in this group, though. That honour goes to Spain. And to tell us more about them, here's our favourite, Alvaro Romeo. Hi, Alvaro.
Hello, James. How are you? I don't know if Spain is the favourite, though. I'm not too sure about that, even to lead the group.
Really? All right. I was just going to say, how's the build-up going? Once again, it's been a difficult pre-tournament for La Roja.
It's been a terrible build-up. That's why I think that Spain cannot be considered favorite over Sweden right now, because the preparations to the tournament have been very difficult. To start with, we shouldn't forget that Luis Enrique had a hiatus for 18 months because he had to quit for personal reasons, and then he came back in September 2020. Then, if Luis Enrique wanted to implement his ideas, the international breaks from October onwards had 3 games, so Spain didn't have quality time to train. And then Spain had 2 weeks now to train, and it looked like the controversy about not having capped any player from Real Madrid was over. The controversy about not having capped Sergio Ramos was over. And on Sunday, Sergio Busquets tested positive for COVID-19, which meant that all the players are training on their own now, waiting for the second negative test so they can go back to training together.
Crikey. Well, at least this time you haven't sacked your manager 2 days before your opening game, is that? Although you have called up Kepa.
Yeah, we have. I mean, there are 6 players in the back partner now in the Spanish national team because Luis Enrique, just in case, had to call Kepa, Pablo Fornals, Rodrigo from Leeds United, Carlos Soler, Bryce Mendes, and Albiol, 6 players who are training in their own bubble, let's call it that way, because, you know, there is the possibility that there are some more positive tests in the Spanish squad, in the Spanish camp. I mean, all of them in the first day tested positive, which was yesterday on Monday, but it could be the case. So those players are there in the back burner. They are training individually. It was a little bit difficult to find some of them. And for example, Spain is playing against Lithuania, a friendly game that was, you know, I think that quite important to prepare the Euro Cup. And the under-21 squad is going to take part in that game and they are going to play it. So as I said before, the preps are really inconvenient for the Spanish national team. And that's why I think that all this, combined with the fact that if you ask me who is going to start for Spain on Monday, I couldn't give you, probably I wouldn't be right in 3 or 4 players either, because Luis Enrique has been rotating so much that it's impossible to know what's happening or what his game plan is. And also, all together with the fact that there are COVID protocols, that the players are training on their own right now, it's very difficult to trust on this Spanish national team in the short term.
Adding to, perhaps, the confusion, the arrival of Aymeric Laporte following his headline-grabbing switch from France to Spain. I imagine, though, that his arrival is pretty welcome given that Ramos isn't there.
Well, there was, as you probably know, a journalist from Madrid. Actually, he's a reporter for Real Madrid for Onda Cero, who asked Sergio Ramos in a very he made a big preamble for his question, talking about nation and anthem, and then he asked Aymeric Laporte how Spanish he felt, and I think that the Frenchman and the Spanishman was quite educated, articulated, and he managed to answer the question politely, but he didn't like it. I think that this debate, the sooner it's gone, the better, because, you know, we'd better get used to one thing, that if you can't play for a national team, that should be the end of the debate. I mean, Aymeric Laporte got the passport on time, and there have been many Spanish players that weren't born in Spain and have defended the national team, like Marcos Senna. He was pivotal to win the Euro in 2008 for Spain. So yeah, the thing with Aymeric Laporte, talking about football now, is that he is a left centre-back, and he's going to play in Spain with another left centre-back, potentially, like Pau Torres. And this is something that you don't see a lot in football. I don't know how all this mix is going to work for Spain, but as I said before, there are too many questions, too many conundrums, and there are only 5 or 6 days to answer all of them.
Not sure if anyone's been counting in Spain, but it's been 9 years since the national side progressed beyond the last 16 of a major tournament. How crucial is the opening game on Monday in Seville against Sweden, Alvaro?
I think that I think it's very important, because that will set the tone for the rest of the tournament. Possibly will solve some questions like who plays up front, who is the goalkeeper, because it looks like it's Unai Simón, but there are rumors that Robert Sanchez may have a slight chance as well, the Brighton goalkeeper. I think that starting strongly is key in this tournament, because at the minute there is a lot of background noise in media, there are doubts with the national team, and anything but a win at home could have probably really bad consequences, or in midterm until the next game, it will spur on the controversy much more.
Okay. You sound as though you're feeling quite pessimistic, Alvaro. We should just remind ourselves that this is a team that recently beat Germany 6-0. So, you know.
Yeah, but I know, Jens. But then in the group stage in March, in the World Cup qualifications, they got 7 points out of 9, but they suffered a lot to beat Kosovo, or they didn't beat Greece at home. So this is a team that at the minute they are short of short of goals up front. They have a goalkeeper who has been shaky, like Unai Simón. Defensive pair that haven't played together too much, like Pau Torres and Aymeric Laporte. Probably the best player that Spain has, or one of the best, like Marcos Llorente, who is a hell of a midfielder. He's playing as a right back, which is not good, because Spain is wasting basically all his attacking power. So there are so many questions. No, I'm not too confident. And let's don't forget another thing. Spain didn't perform well in Russia 2018. Spain didn't perform well in Euro 2016 either, so and they didn't negotiate the group stage in World Cup 2014. So this is not a team that has offered a lot of guarantees lately. That's why I'm telling you that, if you look at the French squad, I mean, it's impressive what they have up front. Then Germany, they've got great midfielders. I look at England and there is something really nice, growing there. But in Spain, I think that the only thing that I can trust on, genuinely, is on a manager who has won a Champions League, because Luis Enrique is a very good manager. And this season, this year alone, Luis Suarez and Lionel Messi, independently, they have said that Luis Enrique is the best manager they ever had. So those are the things that you have to trust on Luis Enrique being a great manager during the tournament. But he is not having the time to train with the players, because there has been a positive. So and he had an 18-month hiatus before the tournament. So, yeah, as I said before, I wouldn't put my money on Spain at this stage.
All right, Alvaro. Well, we'll check in with you as the tournament gets underway to see how things are progressing. For now, though, many thanks.
Thanks to you guys.
Well, there you go. So Sweden, Alvaro has them ahead of Spain, which, not sure if he's being a little bit superstitious there. Poland and Slovakia, though, what are they going to bring, Duncan?
Well, the Polish story is obviously Robert Lewandowski, who's coming off one of the greatest club seasons for an individual player we've ever seen, really, if you put it into context. But his international record in tournaments is nothing to shout about. I actually had a look to try and find the most similar record to Lewandowski. He's scored 2 goals in 11 tournament games from 30 shots. And Martin Peters of England is about roughly the same as that. And not a comparison I've heard too often in football, but it really does feel, particularly at the ages as well now, that he really could, turn this group and the tournament up if he turns up. But as we've seen in previous tournaments, that isn't always the case. So, yeah. For me, that's the real kind of unknown about this group, because I think if he hits the ground running, then Poland could easily win the group. But if he doesn't, then, they could even come bottom. So,
okay. He got no goals whatsoever at the 2018 World Cup. Be interesting to see, as you say, how this time around the things work out. Slovakia, the other team in the group who saw off Republic of Ireland and then Northern Ireland in the playoffs to reach these Euros. Slovakia have actually reached the last 16 in their two previous tournament appearances. How do you feel about Slovakia? Are they worth a preview, Jules?
I'm not sure they were, or just maybe for Marek Hamšík, because at 33, I think this could be the last time we see him really at this kind of tournament and we can enjoy the hair, the style, the swag, everything. Apart from that, the rest, again, it's a bit similar to what we said earlier about Hungary, for example. They would be very solid, they would be quite defensive and try to score on set pieces mostly, because going forward they don't have as much talent maybe as a Czech Republic, for example. So it'd be more limited. But you know, they would be there with no pressure.
Excellent. Well, the tournament gets underway, of course, on Friday in Rome with Italy, Turkey. And our nightly coverage on every game day will begin on Friday as well. Straight off the final whistle, we'll be getting down our thoughts, and that should be with you a few hours after, or probably the next morning, for your convenience. I haven't quite done with today's show, though. Before we go any further, let's get some odds from Jason Murphy of Paddy Power.
As an odds compiler for Paddy Power, a lot of work goes into getting our probabilities right for Euro 2020 and to give you some good insight. In Group C, Netherlands are the only team with home advantage, but we reckon it will be Ukraine who do the most Amsterdam damage. Some may just assume Holland will be as reliably good as that gorgeous jersey, but not in recent times, having missed the last Euros and World Cup. But guess what? The last time they missed back-to-back major tournaments, they won the next one in Euro 88. But Vinnie van Gogh, if you can hear me, we don't think it will be happening this time. Reasons being, Netherlands are one of the teams to lose out with the tournament postponement. Van Dijk, the obvious absentee, but also Koeman leaving for the new camp to be replaced by the less impressive Frank de Boer. Ukraine, on the other hand, have benefited from the delay. Shevchenko will have gained a lot tactically in the last 12 months. Ukraine at 9-2 to win the group seems the better value than the Dutch at 2-5. And Ukraine are genuine dark horses in the outright at 90-1. In Group E, Paulo Sousa taking over Poland in January was a shock. And based on their three games in March, it is unlikely Sousa's plans for more attack-minded football will have had sufficient time to bed in. Luis Enrique, Spain are rightly favourites to win Group B at 3-10. Their main strength is that they will have no superstars, but quality options for every position. One way to get more entertainment from a bet on Spain is as the highest scoring team at 9-2. They've home advantage in all three group games and have scored 34 goals in their last 9 competitive home games. The last group game in particular against a tired and aging Slovakia is a prime opportunity to run up a decent score in the Seville frying pan heat. While Spain are considered greater than the sum of their parts, the same would not be said of Group F contenders Portugal. Disappointing viewing recently against Serbia and Azerbaijan, Fernando Santos has a wealth of attacking talent at his disposal, but will he be able to utilise it? Remember, the reigning champions only won one game in 90 minutes in lifting the trophy in 2016. One thing we Paddy Power odds compilers underestimated was Karim Benzema's return to France, and we have significantly improved our French rating since. I like both Mbappe and Benzema to get a baguette full of goals in this tournament. 9-1 and 12-1 respectively in the top goalscorer market. And remember, back a top goalscorer with Paddy Power for Euro 2020 and get a free bet for every shot on target in the tournament. But bottom line, it is only the lack of home comforts that will see France not go off clear favourites to win the tournament, and are currently 5-1 to win it out. If it is not coming home, then Paddy says it is very likely it is going to Paris.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply, and when the fun stops, stop. Why not sign up for a subscription with The Athletic if you haven't got one already? Because you get unrivaled coverage of Euro 2020 in 21. All the articles, all the podcasts ad-free, and Q&As with writers for £1 a month. £1 a month, that's for your first 6 months. After that, you'll probably need a mortgage or something. But that 6 months there, boom, unrivaled value. Head to theathletic.com/totally. Woof. All right then, Duncan. Nothing stands between us now and kickoff in Rome. What is most getting you hot and bothered? What are you most looking forward to seeing in this crazy month of high-quality international football?
I kind of I just want to see how it unfolds, because I mean, it looked a slightly outlandish structure when it was first announced, and then obviously with everything that's happened, it could, you know, everyone knows international tournaments really bring countries together, you know, brackets if you do okay, but you do wonder how this will go, you know, with big crowds in some places and not in others, and it will be, obviously, but there's issues with, you know, elements of supporters at various nations as well. So it will be interesting to see how the kind of standard tournament fever kind of progresses as it goes on. But I do think it has got the power to really kind of bring some optimism and enjoyment to people's lives, particularly, you know, even the weather's got nice and everything. So it's it's been such a long season. I was slightly not looking forward to it, but I was kind of just not thinking about the Euros too much. But I think the last week, I think everyone can really feel that kind of tournament fever rising. So
yeah, particularly Jules. You can, Jules, although you think we don't even need to hold it. We could just give the trophy to France.
We can go home now. No, I think the good things, if there's a good thing about the fact that it was postponed for a year, is that we will get to see Karim Benzema, and he would not have been there a year ago. We would see Phil Foden, who probably would not have made it, or maybe not even in that kind of form a year ago as well. And there's other players like that, which I think makes it even more exciting. And we had Wales in 2016 going to the semi-final. Who would be the Wales of 2021 or 2020, whatever? I think Turkey, as we said, could be good. Sweden as well. So I think it'd be, apart from the French, a very open tournament.
Brilliant. All right. Well, Friday night then, Italy taking on Turkey kicks it off. And we will be with you the next morning with the first of our daily shows. Do hope you'll be joining us throughout the tournament, listener. For now, many thanks for being with us for this preview, this richly educational experience in the company of Julien Laurens and Duncan Alexander and all of our friends in far-flung corners of the continent. Producer Charlie, as ever, with the sterling work to bring this to your ears. Thank you, guys. We'll be back soon. For now, though, from all of us here, it's adieu.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Head to theathletic.com/totally to find out all the latest subscription offers. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.